Welcome to the Better Boards podcast series. Our mission at Better Boards is to provide proven solutions for creating more effective boards. Our evidence-based board evaluations and board development programs deliver tangible results. To fulfill our mission, we listen and give a voice to all who care about creating better boards. Every time you tune in, we'll help you to develop and reinvigorate your board know-how and practice with insights, data, and practical advice. All the views expressed in our podcast are the views of our podcast partners and not those of Better Boards. In this episode, I'm delighted to welcome Steve Muslin. Steve is the immediate past chair of the Partnership Oversight Board of Grant Thornton. After almost 3 decades at Grant Thornton, Steve has developed an impressive portfolio of commercial boards, charity boards, and committee roles that include Nuffield Health, ARC Schools, the Royal Collection Trust, the Gorkha Museum, and most lately chair of an unlisted building company. Thank you so much, Steve, for participating in our podcast series.
Delighted.
I know that you were involved in a study that explored the link between a board's effectiveness and organizational success. Can you tell us more about the study?
So the research was published recently by my former firm, Grant Thornton, the Governance Institute there, and it was trying to identify whether they could find any measurable connection between good governance behaviours and financial performance. So the background to that research is that the Governance Institute have tracked governance behaviours in the FTSE 350 going back to 2001, and they use a unique set of data which is both qualitative and quantitative. So they score companies' performance against the code. If it's a binary requirement, you get a point for complying. But they look much more about whether there's evidence if the companies have really embraced the spirit of the code. So you get qualitative points as well if you demonstrate you've really embedded the principles behind the code. So, for example, you might get a point if you comply with the code saying that you've reviewed the effectiveness of internal controls, but you can get extra points if you've demonstrated that's a really thorough exercise and as a result of that you've taken robust actions. So the team has built up data going back over 17 years, and what's interesting about the latest research is that they've tracked the performance of FTSE 350 companies in 10 sectors over a 10-year period, and they've ranked the top quartile of best governed companies and the lowest quartile of governed companies to see if they can find a link between financial measures such as total shareholder return. And what they've demonstrated, a clear link over a variety of measures between those best governed companies and the worst.
Wow. Because that is very often questioned, if that actually makes a difference, good governance versus financial performance. And that link is now clearly established.
Based on this research, and it really covers most all of the FTSE 350, so the team has looked at all sectors except for investment trusts. So investment trusts are by their own code, but having stripped those out, they've looked at results across all 10 sectors. And if we look at measures that shareholders would be interested in, across all of those sectors, you see a demonstrably measurable better performance in the best ranked, best governed companies from the lowest quartile. So in terms of total shareholder return, the best governed companies on average produce twice the total shareholder return from those in the bottom quartile. They have generated 3 times the level of operating cash, and they're up to 40% more efficient at making their goods and services as those in the bottom ranking. There are also factors there of interest to other providers of capital, such as banks and other lenders, because for 7 of the sectors, again, you see positive governance behaviours playing out in terms of financial performance. So the best governed companies have 25% more liquid reserves, they tend to be 15% more solvent, and they were twice as likely to retain their FTSE 350 status. So the governance team at Grant Thornton in more recent years have broadened their research to look at other types of entities such as charities, large unlisted companies, some government agencies like NHS trusts. That data isn't yet sufficiently mature for them to do the trend analysis, but I'd be amazed if it doesn't produce the same sorts of findings.
Wow, that is very clear, convincing numbers. What do the findings of this study really mean for boards in your perspective?
Well, I think boards have to make their own use of these things, but I think there are, for me, three really clear messages coming out from the research. And the governance team put together this study, really helpfully put together a kind of framework and possible action plan for boards. And three key messages, really. The first important thing is clearly articulate the business model and the purpose of the organisation and demonstrate how your cultural values are integrated into the business. That's a really big thing. If we look at some of the big collapses in companies across the world, the bedrock of that has been poor culture rather than just financial scandal. So clearly understand how the business makes money and generates cash and link that to your business model, your strategic objectives and your risks. And I think one really important thing for boards as they do that is to remember that things like environmental and social issues will increasingly now start to drive the decisions of investors and banks and other providers of capital. So you've got to start building those things into your thinking. Think about not just shareholders or management, but a wide array of stakeholders. How will they judge the company to be successful in the longer term? Think beyond your short-term profit ambitions. So that's the first thing, I think, around business purpose and culture. The second thing I think is really, really important is to look at risk management and internal control and treat those areas as really, really important generators and creators of value rather than just some sort of compliance nuisance. So, you know, really understand where your business risks are, understand the control framework so you're not making assumptions about how they're being controlled and mitigated on a day-to-day basis, and make sure that you are getting people involved in the business to come back and explain to you how they're embedding in the control environment. That gives you a framework where you can empower people to make decisions quickly, as long as they're doing so in accordance with your risk appetite. Most importantly, I think where I see a lot of boards going wrong is think about your risk process and your control framework as a forward-looking dynamic exercise. Too many boards, I think, look at things historically. They have had a risk register for a number of years and they toss up how good they are at clearing off the points from the internal audit department. But think about what are the emerging risks, things around disruptors in your organisation, new technologies. The battle for talent has got to be a problem and a business risk for all sectors. Thinking about stakeholders changing attitudes to your use of scarce resources, make it dynamic, make sure that you're thinking about those emerging risks and thinking about your risk appetite and how you're going to control them. And then third, I think really truly embrace the concept of board effectiveness evaluation and succession planning. So if you look at the Grant Thornton research, the best governed companies are three times more likely to demonstrate they've taken action as a result of the board evaluation, and they're four times more likely to demonstrate that they've got a clear succession plan, not just for the board, but at senior tiers of management. The best governed companies are confident to recognise where they've got blind spots in their leadership team and where they need to create new skills and experiences on the board to cope with the business, how it will be going forward. I think just one other thing to mention is there's going to be increasing focus on diversity. And ICSA, the Chartered Secretaries, is preparing some work for VASE on diversity. So we can expect to see something interesting coming out in 2020.
So how do you integrate these insights in your work on boards? I mean, you have an enviable portfolio of board roles. How do you make it really happen? How do you bring the study results to life in your daily board work?
So for me, it really starts with purpose and culture. And that doesn't matter if you're talking about a charity, a large partnership like Grant Thornton, or a large commercial organisation. It really starts with that clarity of purpose and culture. So if I take Nuffield Health as an example, one of the boards that I'm involved with, Nuffield operates in two sectors, very competitive sectors, private hospitals and private gyms, but we're a charity. So the board has been on a two-year cycle about really, really re-articulating what's its purpose, what is its place in society as a business that's in a very competitive sector, but we're a charity. We have articulated that purpose as helping to build a healthier nation. And so in 2018, we flipped all of our internal and external reporting metrics. If you look at our 2018 annual report, it will have a very different look and feel about it. In the past, we tended to focus, like many other companies, just on financial results, and then as an afterthought, talk about the jolly good work we've done. Whereas in the 2018 report, we very much are focused on delivery of our charitable and social purpose, about how we're going about trying to build a healthier nation, how we are performing in terms of our quality and safety scores as measured by the independent regulator. Clearly, we have to make money. We have to generate cash in order to deliver that social purpose. But those measures come right at the end of our metrics rather than at the beginning. And we've started to embed that thinking in our investment decisions. So if we go back 18 months, our investment boards were probably like many others, they would focus on a traditional measure of financial rate of return. Whereas now, if the management team wants some approvals for significant capital expenditure, they have to demonstrate how that will help people. The next two things as we go into 2020 will be to relook at our executive remuneration so that there's a much clearer link incentivizing our senior leadership team, again, not just on financial measures, but to think about how we're delivering that social purpose. And we're also trying to be more sophisticated in our measures of what it means to build a healthier nation. We started off with very broad measures about the number of people we would help. We're now starting to think about what are we doing for that demographic that doesn't normally get access to private healthcare and private gyms. What are we doing for people in really challenging parts of society? So we're now setting ourselves targets about how we're delivering free access to those people for programs we think will be helpful to them. That switch in purpose, interestingly, so far has come at a time when, in terms of traditional financial performance, we've outperformed our private sector competitors.
You outperformed?
Yeah, in recent years. We're not complacent about that. But I think it shows the point that, if you like, have your cake and eat it, you can reposition your business to think about its real purpose and its place in society and still make money.
This is so interesting. Can you maybe give another example from one of your other charity boards? How you implemented the results of the study?
Let me go back to my time as chair at Grant Thornton. So Grant Thornton is a large professional partnership. And at the time I became chair, we had a new CEO. And unusually for me, I was quite granular about rethinking our membership constitution. And we got very, very detailed about the responsibilities of the respective organs in the firm. So traditionally, like many partnerships, Grant Thornton was one that had 200 or 300 partners, and they all regarded themselves as having an equal say in important decisions like what were going to be the colours of the carpet in the London office. But you can't run a £500 million operation like that. So over time, we changed the constitution to create a CEO, put a huge amount of powers into the hands of the CEO, who was then responsible for delivering on the success of the business. We put a board around, a monitoring board, a governance board around the CEO to monitor the CEO was doing good things by the partnership as a whole. When I became chair, that was fine, but we hadn't got sufficiently specific about what that meant, what was a good thing, what was looking after the interests of the partners as a whole. So we got very, very detailed about what should a partner in Grant Thornton expect, what should be expected of that partner. We provided real clarity in terms of what was the responsibilities of the CEO, what could the CEO do of his or her own volition, what could they do provided they come back to the board and give the board a meaningful opportunity to challenge those business plans, and what were the responsibilities that were reserved for the board in isolation. I think that was important. That time did coincide with a period of real success for the firm. It doubled its turnover from 250 million to 500 million. It more than doubled its profitability. But I think more than all of those things, it did start to carve out for itself a real place in terms of the marketplace. But a lot of that comes down to being quite precise about what good looks like in terms of your purpose.
You really embrace the results of the study, and I detect a lot of passion about your work and the board roles. What drives you, really?
I think A number of my basic motivations have probably stayed the same from when I was 4 years old and used to go around with my mum cleaning office floors. So I come from a pretty humble background, lived in a bedsit till I was 14 and watched my mum and dad work crazy hours to improve their lot and the family lot and get on in life. And I guess that work ethic and continual determination to make whatever you can of the gifts you've been given. I think that's always been a powerful motivator. And even now I'm 62, that's still a motivator to not leave this earth when there are things that challenges I might have taken on that I haven't done. I think I'm pretty lucky, though, on a number of things. And there's been a small measure of financial success for my professional career. So I think that's now allowed me to only work with organisations where I really admire the purpose. And I think, you know, there's some societal good coming from the purpose of that entity and where I can really relate to the culture.
A lot of people would love to have a portfolio career like you have now. Step out of the rat race, sit on various boards and do the nice things. How did you manage to make this transition from being a senior partner at Grant Thornton to basically being a member of numerous boards?
It's a really interesting question, Sabine. And I'm not, in many facets of my life, I'm not the best planned person. You know, I kind of cope and been surrounded by great teams that have often done a lot of my planning for me. But I did quite serious and thoughtful about planning my career, probably from 5 years out from when I knew was going to be my backstop retirement date from Grant Thornton. So I've never described myself as a voracious networker, but I do always try and take the opportunity to meet people and talk to them and stay in touch with them. So I set myself a goal 5 years before retirement of trying to find a charitable position, but a worthwhile charitable organisation. And one of the things that's made me really, really angry is that I had a great opportunity coming from a humble background. I had access to a brilliant education, and that allowed me to unlock all of the potential that was there in me. I am not convinced that everybody who comes from that same sort of humble background these days have the same opportunities and access to education. So when I was introduced to the people at ARC Schools, it was an unpaid position, but it was a great organisation. ARC now has 37 schools. We touch 26,000 pupils from the most challenging areas in society. So that was an easy thing to want to get involved with. A couple of years later, before stepping down as a partner in my old firm, the Nuffield opportunity came along. And I'd known some of the board at Nuffield. It was a client of mine many, many years ago. And I'd stayed in contact with them. And I can get quite passionate about Nuffield, because it is this hybrid. It's a commercially run organisation, but we don't have to pay a dividend to shareholders. I remember growing up in the 60s and 70s when government tried to run social services and the country didn't work. We go through the years of privatisation under Thatcher, and there have been some improvements, but a lot of private companies shoot themselves in the foot again and again and again by not doing a good job of delivering social services. So this idea of a very commercially run organisation with very commercial people, but running a charity that doesn't have to pay a dividend to shareholder and can really focus on its social and charitable purpose, I just think that's a really interesting model, one I was really keen to take up the opportunity. I had to go through the most onerous nominations process, but I got there. And I just think Nuffield is that type of model is a really interesting one that could be explored in other areas apart from health. And then I guess with those two things on my CV, it's much easier, and you find that you get opportunities to do things. And all of those opportunities really have just come about from people I've got to know, and I respect them, and it seems that they respect me. So I'm very lucky.
Fantastic, Steve. Thank you so much. The study is a huge step forward, I think, in governance. And thank you for giving us such personal insights.
Sabine, thank you very much.
As a note for your diary, new episodes are available every first and third Thursday of the month. Subscribe on Apple or Google Podcasts to never miss an episode. We love to hear from you. If you would like to contribute to a future podcast, or attend our popular breakfast conversations and receive regular updates on our activities. You can reach us on info@better-boards.com.